Okay, so the thing about my brother is my brother always had schemes, always, forever plotting and planning for the next big score. So when I call to tell him that he needs to move to Japan, I know just the right words to use. Dude, it's the land of opportunity over here. Forget go west, young man. Instead, go east. But can I get paid? Yeah, you can get paid. He comes over and sets right to work. First, he's got this psychic friend phone exchange thing. Then there's an import-export scheme selling stamps from Palau. And there's the ever-present phone card scam. Whatever it is, he knows it's gonna be the next big thing. And he's loving it. Blah, good call. This Japan thing is great. And one night, he takes me out to see a show. He promises that these guys are gonna be the next big thing. Huge, huge, I guarantee it. All right, man. We go, and it's terrible. Two Japanese guys called the Marioka Brothers or something, and they're doing some kind of awful James Brown impersonation. Horrible. Horrible like they're wearing blackface horrible. Trying to be black, and it's so bad, I'm embarrassed for them. My bro drags me backstage after the show, and the two guys, looking all downcast, they cheer up when they see him. My bro tells him not to worry. No problem, fellas. Mondai nayo. Anatatachi sugoizo. I'm gonna hook y'all up with some soul. Kakui yo. And I'm like, good luck with that. No, dude, help me help them. Don't you see? Well, pick up some corny English line to stick in the song if we can't lose. I tell them, there's not enough soul in the world to help these fools. So it's maybe 3 months later. My brother takes me out again. And it's not till we're at the club having a drink that he springs it on me. Hey, remember that group I was working with? Well, everything is fixed. They're about to come out now. I'm gonna go on tour with them. I laugh out loud. Brother, they suck. They suck so bad. Their suckiness is gonna suck around and suck up other stuff that sucks. I told you, I fixed it. Throw in some nonsense lines, some English words, it's all set. We're going on a 12-city tour. Right. Watch the crowd, see if I'm lying. The guys come out, and a few of the ladies actually scream. This time, they've cleaned up, wearing these aluminum foily suits, and they've got a new name, the Bubblegum Brothers. And immediately, I have to admit, something's different. They've got a head shake, a confidence, a swagger, and it's not their swagger, it's his swagger. My brother's. And then I hear him sing along. Audi, 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 yo! Yadi, 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 ya! It's kind of nice. My brother's like, wait for it, they got a line.
The Uptown Tokyo Slammin' Night!
What did they say? Uptown Tokyo Slammin' Night? Did you make that up? You didn't make that up. Who made that up?
I told you, man. Gonna make big cash. It's gonna be the next big thing.
And here's the story. My brother's actually right. The song ends up being the next big thing, a huge, crazy, super monster hit. But, the tour bus takes off without him on it. My brother doesn't make a dime, not a single yen. He acts like he doesn't care, but being his older sibling, I love pouring salt in new wounds. And I ask him, what's up with those Bubblegum Brothers? And he's like,
forget them, man. That's old news. But hey, if you got some extra change, you're not going to believe the deal I got going on a robot sake bar.
Well, today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Fool's Gold. Fool's Gold. Amazing stories where real people discover that all that glitters is not gold. My name is Glenn Washington. Please make sure all your valuables are properly accounted for, because this is Snap Judgment. Now then, here at the Snap Judgment, you know that we do some serious, hard-hitting pieces, right? But not right now. At least not yet. You see, we called the Pulitzer Committee and we told them, we don't need your stinking prizes. We don't care. Good storytelling is its own reward. Mark, am I right? Now, our first piece today on that theme comes to us from a storyteller. A storyteller by the name of Tim Tate.
The time is the mid-60s. The place? Anywhere suburban USA. My brother is 8, I am 9 years old. We love a magazine called Monster Magazine, which we read religiously and get every single month. This month, in the back of Monster Magazine, besides itching powder and x-ray glasses, you could purchase a monkey. Not a sea monkey, not a stuffed monkey, an actual squirrel monkey the size of a cat, a big cat. And you only had to send $19.95. And we had $19.95 because we washed cars, we mowed lawns. So my brother and I think, this will be the best idea we've ever had. Because not only will he do our chores for us, and we will love him and he will love us, but also he will go to school with us. Everybody at school will love us because we have a monkey on our shoulder. It was going to treat all of our ills. So we decide that this would be the best idea we ever had, but we knew from experience that if we asked my mom in advance, there was but one outcome. The answer would be no. But we also knew that any half-dead, kind of bedraggled, moth-eaten animal we dragged home, she would let us keep because she was a big softie. So with both those pieces of knowledge, we sent off for our own monkey. We decide his name will be Pepe. We make him a little hat and a cape, and we will dress him when he comes, and everyone will know him because his name will be Pepe. So we send off the money and we wait. About 3 weeks go by, and back then, women had bridge tournaments with the women from the country club. This was one of those days. So my mom's having a big bridge party. We've been squeezed into our plaid jackets and little red bow ties. And our hair's been slicked down, and we look very nice, and we look like twins, and we're just kind of sitting in there smiling so we don't embarrass anybody, and they're just pointing and pinching our cheeks.
He's just so cute. Oh, my goodness.
By the way, the cardinal rule in our house is you never, ever embarrass your mother in front of the bridge club. That is the worst thing you can do. So, as we sit there, petrified that we might embarrass our mother, there's a knock at the door. It's the postman. And the postman has a box addressed to me and my brother. And it's the size of a shoebox. And in the front of the shoebox is a little tiny metal grill. And on the little metal grill, what we see is a little monkey's mouth going up against this thing. So my mother, seeing this monkey and seeing it's from Monkey Island or wherever it was from, and she says, "Oh my God, I don't care what the boys have ordered. Take this thing back. It's not coming to my house. Take it back where you got it from. I don't want this thing in my home." And the postman says, "If I take him back, he will die." So now my brother and I are about to have a stage 4 meltdown in front of the Bridge Club, which she cannot have, right? And we know that she's sending our friend away to a certain death. So she says, "Oh, for God's sakes, all right, put the monkey in the kitchen. Now, your father's at the hardware store. Now, listen, when he comes back and when this Bridge Club is over, we will resolve this monkey issue. But in the meantime, you do not touch that box. You do not go in the kitchen. You don't even look in the kitchen. You don't smell the kitchen. You stay out here. And when I finish with the Bridge Club and your father's home, we will deal with it at that time and not a second before." And then she goes back down to play bridge. But we are 8 and 9 years old. We have a monkey in the box in the kitchen. There's no power on this planet that is going to keep us out. Now, being 8 and 9, you know where all the creaking floorboards are. So we dig up our shoes and we silently creep into the kitchen. "You aren't near that monkey, are you?" "Of course not, of course not." Then we run back to where we were. So we go in the kitchen and we see that the box has a little frayed corner. So we think to ourselves, all right, if we take a little knife, we can help that corner and help Pepe escape. So it looked like he just came out on his own because we know he's like suffocating there. We just can't take it. So we get the steak knife out. And at first we're tepid and we're kind of slowly kind of working it to let it open. But pretty soon we just start hacking at the box. We're stabbing at it and the monkey's darting a screech, dodging this knife coming at it right and left. Finally, boing, out pops Pepe. Now, monkeys are very, very, very smart creatures. They do not defecate in enclosed places. And he has been waiting a long, long time in that box. And so, sadly, now he's freaked out because a knife's been plunging out of him. He's been shipped in a shoebox. So now, as he screeches at the top of his lungs, bites us with needle-like teeth, and runs into the living room, there's an arc of urine in front of him and a huge trail of defecation wherever he went around that living room. So now the women, hearing that there's something screeching outside, thinking, "Oh my God, what happened?" run up the steps with their arms up, going, "Oh my God, what's going on? Oh my God." In those years, women had huge beehives that were sprayed and stinky and horrible. And Pepe decides at this moment in time that the best defense is a very strong offense, and leaps on one of the women and gets entangled in her hair. And he starts biting on the poor woman, who's now bleeding and screaming and crying. And at this moment, my poor father walks back into the house. When he left, he was a mild-mannered accountant in the suburbs with two lovely children and the Bridge Club downstairs. And now he thinks a rabid squirrel is broken. And he has no idea what it is because it couldn't be a monkey. It was not even in his comprehension. And so the monkey had run behind the sofa. And so he runs down and gets big leather garden gloves. And he comes upstairs and he traps the monkey in the corner behind the sofa. And we pull my sister's old crib with screened sides. We push it out in the front lawn. And we put Pepe inside the crib. And then we put a screen door on top of that. And then we put bricks on top of that. And then all eyes turn to my brother and I. Now, we are in trouble, of course, but at this point, my aunt is visiting. So before any horrible retribution can happen to my brother and I, my aunt speaks up. And she says, "Oh, look how sweet he's been. There's a nice monkey. Look, he's, and you know, I mean, the boys were stabbing him and he was shipped in a shoebox. And, you know, he's had a tough life. And I've never pet a monkey. I just want to pet a little monkey. Let me pet him. I bet I can calm him down." So my aunt goes over but where an arm can go in, a monkey can come out. And out comes Pepe. And a monkey who believes he's about to go to the next beyond, in panic, jumps out, and to escape, bites the first thing in front of his eyes. And what is that? That is my aunt's pendulous breast. So the monkey bites her so hard on her breast that his head is shaking back and forth. So he bites her. And now my aunt lets out a blood-curdling screech that the entire neighborhood can hear. And she screeches like high heaven. And finally, she swats Pepe off. He runs into the woods behind the house. We search for him every single day. So we would call Pepe and we would leave food for him constantly. We had Purina Monkey Chow because there were so many people with monkeys back then, I guess. In fact, our mother would go up and buy Monkey Chow for us, even though she had no real desire to, but we would make her go buy Monkey Chow. She would give us bananas. She would do whatever we had to take food to Pepe. We leave toys out in the woods. We go home after school and we have a group of our friends together. And we all say, you know, help us today. And different people would help us on different days. And we would scour the woods endlessly. And we would always think we caught a glimpse of Pepe, just a little tail somewhere or a little face around the corner, which most of the time turned out to be a squirrel. But sometimes we thought we saw him. And so we always were sure that he was there. At night, out of our bedroom windows, we would see him in the trees in our minds, looking over us. And we knew he was waiting to come back home. And we did this for, it must have been 2 or 3 months. And then one day, we find his little desiccated body at the foot of an oak tree. We take it and we dress poor Pepe in the cape and hat that might have been his, that circumstance has been different. We put him back in the box that he originally was shipped in. We get our wagon and we put black crepe paper around the entire wagon. We borrow our parents' giant black clothes, my father's black suit, and we have a hat. And we've rolled up our sleeves and cuffs because they're way too long, but we have this huge funeral procession. We've got our friends to go behind it, and we finally get around to the backyard. My father's there with a shovel going, you know, put the thing in the ground. But we're very solemn, and we bury him in the backyard, and we have made a tombstone for him out of paper mache that we spent days making, and it said, R.I.P. Pepe, our dearest friend. And we finally bury him, and we plant flowers around the gravesite. And there he still lies, peacefully resting in this moment. The tombstone is gone, but the area is full of flowers, so he always will be there, happily covered in flowers. There is an addendum to the story, and that is my mother, many years later, as she was on her deathbed, pulled us aside and said she had something to admit. And we thought, oh my God, this must be something horrible. Oh my God, what could she be hiding that she would have to admit it on his deathbed? And what she decided to tell us and admit at that moment was that during that time, the newspapers, radios, and televisions had all had sightings, monkey sightings, all around our neighborhood. And they were trying to find out who the owner of the monkey was. So if the monkey was captured, they knew who to return it to. And for God's sakes, my mother said, I hid all those newspapers. And if it was coming on the TV, I shooed you out of the room and I hid all that from you so you would never do it because she was so afraid the monkey would be returned to the house. So that was her big confession, but of course, we had forgiven her. But Pepe, who now lives on forever in story form, sadly left us much too quickly.
Yes, we know, and we didn't do it. And I can promise you that no monkeys were hurt in the making of this story. And if you think it's a good idea to order a monkey in the mail, please turn yourself into the nearest police officer at once. Rest in peace, Pepe. That story was originally performed by Tim Tate for Speakeasy DC. It's a live storytelling nonprofit. That piece was produced by Julia Botero, with sound design by Pat Messina Miller and Leon Muramoto. Now, when Snap Judgment continues, we're going to make big money the old-fashioned way. We're going to gamble for it. When the Fool's Gold episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Fool's Gold episode. Today, we're looking for traps. Today, we're wondering what could possibly go wrong. Today, we've got a plan for getting over, and it would be stupid, short-sighted, and absurd, really, not to bet at all. Right? Right? Snap Judgment's Nancy Lopez has a story.
The game has a lot to do with life. It's practically a metaphor for life.
The game is roulette, and it was Gonzalo Pelayo's favorite game at the casino near his home in Madrid, Spain. In roulette, you bet on numbers that are arranged randomly on a wheel. The dealer spins the wheel, tosses a ball, and whatever number the ball lands on is the winner. People generally think of it as a game of sheer luck. But the more Gonzalo played, the more
I started to realize that the wheel had a physical defect. And so I found that some numbers were coming up more frequently than others.
So he started keeping track of which numbers came up the most, and it was true. Each individual roulette wheel wasn't perfectly aligned. It tilted in one direction or the other. When the dealer spun the wheel and tossed the ball, that ball was likely to land on certain numbers more often than others.
And of course, I got very excited about the possibilities, realizing that any little physical defect in the wheel could tip things in my favor.
Suddenly, this game of cosmic luck became totally winnable. So, the husband and father of five dropped everything to make a living off of this game. He'd already figured out what set of numbers each roulette wheel in the casino consistently leaned to. All he had to do now was play those numbers long enough, and like that, he would win. But Gonzalo knew he couldn't do it alone. He needed troops on the ground, people who could spend a chunk of their day at a roulette wheel, playing.
My first thought was, the closer the bond with the people I was going to work with, the better the trust.
So Gonzalo reached out to family. The first person he approached was his college-age son, Ivan, who thought his dad's proposal was a little crazy.
No matter how much love a son may have for his father, you might be a little suspicious when your father tells you,
tengo lo que nadie ha descubierto nunca en el mundo.
I have something no one else in the world has discovered.
But Ivan agreed to at least do a test run.
He said, hey dad, if this works, the ideal and sensible thing to do is to play with small amounts of money, not risk too much, and see if your strategy actually delivers results.
Gonzalo agreed to start off small, with $2,000. And slowly, over the course of just a few days, father and son were beating the game of roulette. They started doubling their bets. Now Ivan was fully on board. He recruited three of his cousins. Gonzalo brought on his wife, Carmen. His daughter Vanessa joined a few weeks later, and then so did his ex-wife. Each and every member of the group dedicated themselves to this endeavor full-time, going to the casino 6 days a week, 8 hours a day.
Our system was, the more we played, the better. That's why we never let a day go by without playing. Everyone played at different tables, never together, in order to take full advantage of the time we had at the wheel. My wife, Carmen, was the one who assisted us, who would go around checking up on each player and see if they had enough chips. She would report back to me and let me know how everyone was doing.
In a matter of weeks, just like Gonzalo predicted, they doubled their money again. So they went bigger.
We started betting up to $150 a number.
On a good day, they'd take home $5,000.
It was this sense of, say, rebelliousness, like the weak against the strong, like David against Goliath.
Gonzalo Pelayo and his family, or the Pelayos, became familiar faces at the casino, and Gonzalo, always a step ahead, developed a code to keep the group under the radar. The last thing he wanted was to draw attention. He broke it down to his family like this.
Don't talk about our system to anybody. We're just regular players who do this for fun. Leave the casino as soon as your shift is up. Don't linger. Don't have dinner or any type of relationship inside the casino. And of course, only play the roulette you're assigned and only the number you've been given. In other words, be efficient. This is a job.
They won so consistently that when they didn't win, they got really nervous.
Sometimes they would express their concerns. Look, we're having a bad streak. I would examine that wheel closely and then give him a peace of mind that a good player knows how to be patient. And wait, and soon enough, the winning streak will come. For months, nobody noticed that we were a winning group, not even the casino.
In less than a year, the Pelayos had amassed about $500,000 in winnings. But then they got a little too comfortable. Gonzalo's nephew, Jaime, strayed from protocol. He'd been flirting with a female dealer, a young good-looking girl, who happened to be the ex-girlfriend of the casino's director. The director got jealous and kept a close eye on Jaime and the girl. That's when he noticed something odd. Jaime was winning an awful lot at a game where the odds are typically against the player.
They started looking at all members of the family and realized that the whole group was beating the house in a very clear and definite way. When they realized this, they put up all kinds of obstacles.
One day, Gonzalo and his family showed up to find that the roulette tables had been switched. This actually wasn't a problem. Gonzalo knew what each roulette wheel looked like, so they went and found the tables in their new spot. They kept playing, and they kept winning. Finally, the casino director said, "That's it, you're done," and went as far as to deny Gonzalo and his family access to the casino.
It was so frustrating to go weeks without playing. I mean, we had something that was a real treasure, and they would not let us have access to that treasure. We couldn't play, so we couldn't win.
Then one day, when the Pelayos were finally allowed back into the casino, Gonzalo immediately saw that the axis of each roulette wheel had been changed, essentially throwing Gonzalo's strategy out the window. A couple of weeks later, Gonzalo decided to fight back in the only way he could think of.
I took it upon myself to get kicked out of the casino. So I was playing and winning, and one of the directors approached me and said to me, "Please leave the casino." I said no. I saw no reason to.
Gonzalo figured that if he could get the authorities on his side for being wrongly kicked out, he'd get the casino finally off his back.
Two big guys approached me. They each grabbed me by an arm and started walking me towards the door. A big crowd formed. People stopped what they were doing. It was not a pleasant experience. I told them, "If you stop and let me go, I'll go back to the table and play. You'll have to force me out the door, because I'm not going to walk out on my own." And that's what happened. They dragged me to the door and pushed me out.
Gonzalo's plan didn't work. In fact, he'd sealed his fate with that move, and now it would be impossible to continue playing at the casino in Madrid. But the Pelayos couldn't fold now.
You have to live life. And this was a profession now. This was how we were making a living. And a good one. The world is very big, so we started to travel to other casinos, in Amsterdam and Paris.
The Pelayos beat the house everywhere else they went in Europe, Germany, Holland, Belgium. They'd stay in each country up to 3-4 months at a time, playing until they couldn't play anymore. And all this time, Gonzalo believed that the troubles he'd faced with the casino in Spain were well behind him.
The first day in Austria goes bad. The next day, we win way more than what we lost the day before. And by the third day, they wouldn't let us into the casino. We learned later that the casino in Madrid had alerted the people in Austria about us. When they saw us, they already knew who we were. In other words, we had a very clear reputation, unfortunately.
For the Pelayos, it was now a race to make it to the next casino before their reputation did. But as the months went on, it felt like the whole European continent was closing in around them. In Paris, they were also denied entry. When they arrived to the casino in Copenhagen,
Entonces un tipo nos enseñó una pistola.
The security guard pointed to the gun he had inside his coat and told us to leave.
At the casino in Holland.
As soon as we got there, my wife heard somebody say in German, "Los Pelayos are here." I mean, this did fill me with a little pride, but it was unfortunate that we didn't have the peace of mind to be able to play and win. They started to manipulate the wheel, so logically, our outlook was starting to be pretty dark.
By this point, a couple of years had gone by. Different members of the group started to break away, Gonzalo's daughter, then one of his nephews, then the other. They'd had a good run, but were ready to go back home to Madrid and resume their lives. But not Gonzalo. He had just set his sights on something much bigger.
So the idea to go to Las Vegas was kind of like the ultimate prize, like a dream come true. For any player, to win in Las Vegas is to know that you mastered the highest level.
Gonzalo packed his bags and, accompanied by what was left of the group, his wife and his son Ivan, boarded a plane to try his luck in the biggest casino in the world, the MGM. The MGM was right in the middle of the strip. There were 6,000 hotel rooms. The casino alone was 150,000 square feet. There were spas and pools and shows. But Gonzalo headed straight for the casino.
The world of Las Vegas was such a thrill that I played practically every day.
The casino was busy all night long, 24/7, so no one caught on to their game. And more importantly, no one in the States had ever heard of the Pelayos. They were free to play and play and win and win. Gonzalo had been playing practically every day for 3 months.
Because I was such a regular, the casino invited me to a Mike Tyson fight. When it was over, I wanted to keep playing. It was like any other night. I was winning some, then losing some, then winning again. This is not like a movie where you arrive and win right away. There's always a balance.
But there was one major difference that night. The number Gonzalo didn't want, the number with the least odds of coming up, number 19, was right between the two numbers he did want.
At around 6 in the morning, the number 19 comes up. I challenge it. It's going to be very difficult for you to come up a second time.
He knew the probability of 19 coming up again was minuscule.
Pero aunque fueran exactamente iguales, son dos números.
On top of that, I had two numbers against one. So logically, of every three balls that get tossed, I could only lose once.
The dealer tossed the ball.
And then, the ball lands on number 19 a second time.
Gonzalo quickly ran the calculation through his head again, assuring himself that there's absolutely no way number 19 could come up three times in a row.
So I challenged it again and said, "No, you're not going to come up a third time. You don't have the audacity to come up again. I have no doubt that I'm going to win this bet."
The dealer tossed the ball.
It comes up a third time. And then I felt this sensation of utter defeat, and I fell flat to the ground.
Gonzalo collapsed at the foot of the roulette table. He could vaguely see people's faces gathering around him. And in that split second before he lost consciousness, one thought ran through his mind.
The truth is, I was overcome with a sense of total failure.
Gonzalo was so knocked out by the time he got to the hospital that the doctors thought he'd suffered a heart attack. It was a panic attack. The way Gonzalo sees it, the intense life he'd been leading those 3 years, on top of the confrontations with casinos from Spain to Austria to Denmark, exploded then and there in Vegas.
2 days later, I felt inspired to play again. I felt good. I felt recovered. It was incredible, because as soon as I approached the casino, the same bodily sensations I felt when I passed out came on again. Right then I realized I couldn't set foot in the casino. I couldn't even go in.
As much as Gonzalo wanted to play, he'd lost his confidence.
It's kind of what happens to the bullfighter after he's been gored. He's afraid to face the bull again. We immediately decided to return to Spain. There was no point in playing anymore.
Se aprende perdiendo. Eso es una...
You learn by losing. That's something that I've taken from this game.
Of course, Gonzalo Pelayo didn't entirely fold. He's just keeping his bets where you can't see him. That piece was produced by Nancy Lopez, sound designed by Renzo Gorio, and translated by Martin Aguilera. Now when Snap Judgment returns, we're going to ruin a song for you forever. That's when Snap Judgment, the Fool's Gold episode, continues. You stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the Fool's Gold episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're chasing things that we are not meant to have. Our next story comes to us from Snap favorite Scott Sanders. He's been on the show a few times, but this time he comes to us with a story that starts out when he's a young man traveling in Greece.
We walk into the cafe, and immediately on my left, I see this woman.
It was 1973 on the island of Santorini in the Greek islands. There's one town perched up on steep Mediterranean coastal cliffs. Supposedly Atlantis was somewhere around there. Just one of those magical kind of places, or at least a really great place to meet a woman.
She has long black hair, sort of piercing hazel eyes. But unusual in that you couldn't easily characterize her. Sort of knew without even knowing that something about this woman.
Her name was Sarah. Scott was 21, and he was traveling around Europe hitchhiking, looking for just these kinds of unpredictable opportunities. So he started talking to her. Turns out she was a New Yorker like Scott. She missed the smell of the subways, just like Scott. But that was it, just small talk. Then she left the island. He figured, probably never see her again. But he couldn't stop thinking about her.
The way she walked, the lilt in her voice, you know, the je ne sais quoi. From the second I laid my eyes on her, I was totally fascinated by her.
But Scott figures that's it. He heads to Marseille, France, where he plans to take a train to Paris.
Tired, I was hungry, I was feeling sorry for myself. And I was on the platform in the Marseille train station. There was wispy train smoke all around. And in one of the windows, maybe this is about 200 feet away, I see Sarah. And she's gesturing wildly to get my attention. And I start running down the platform. I spring onto the train. It was only going like 2, 3, 4 miles an hour, but I was euphoric that I caught up to the train. I run down the aisle of the train.
Sarah comes running down the aisle to meet him.
We hugged.
At that moment, he didn't kiss her, but they did have a chance to make up for it later, because as soon as they got to Paris, they moved in together. And let's just say they weren't in Paris for the food.
Sarah was 5 years older than me. And she was a, sort of a very mature 26-year-old, and I was a little bit of an immature 21-year-old as far as sexual experiences. That was very enjoyable also. It was very enlightening in the best sense of the word. And what's better than being in Paris and getting enlightened and educated in that manner?
But eventually it had to end. Sarah had to go home, and Scott stayed behind.
Of course, within 2 days of Sarah leaving, I was frantically trying to change my ticket to get on a flight to New York as soon as possible. Changed my flight, booked a ticket, and Sarah met me at the airport.
And kind of just like that, Scott follows Sarah back to New York and into a real, regular, long-term relationship. One of those rare cases where a wild tryst actually turns into the real thing.
Our relationship seemed very good. I was totally into her. totally into her, in maybe not so much in a healthy way to be so into somebody. And she loved me, but it was sort of disproportionate. It wasn't completely balanced. It's one of those relationships where I would see her walking across the street on the way home before she saw me. And I would think, God, I'm lucky that I'm with this woman.
I guess I'm just lucky, so and so.
They were together for 2 years, living in what Scott figured was relative domestic bliss. Until on one otherwise totally regular afternoon.
Sarah takes this phone call. And, you know, sometimes you can just sense that something significant has just happened. And I said, what's up? Who is that? And she said that it was Joe Brooks, the film director that she had met, you know, couple of years earlier when she was an extra in one of his films, that he was inviting her out and that she was going to do it. I sort of knew it was more than a drink by her tone and the way she looked at me. And I sort of knew a little bit about Joe Brooks, that he was a bit of a ladies' man, and he doesn't ask somebody for a drink for a drink.
Joe Brooks was rich and famous. And suddenly her life with Scott didn't look so glamorous.
Sarah had sort of changed channels. She was ready to move on. And it happened in a blink of an eye. And the world sort of stopped for me. I was crushed. I couldn't understand it. It was inexplicable. If you wanted to, like, put a dagger in a relationship, this was the way to do it.
Scott's friends were watching this, so they started trying to take him out to distract him.
About a week after we split up, a friend of mine had really good tickets to a Knicks game. And Sarah would never, ever, ever go to a basketball game with me. I'd, like, try to get her to go to a basketball game with me, you know, many times. It turned out that she was going to the game with Joe Brooks, and they had courtside seats. Turned out to be a triple overtime, one of the biggest games in basketball history. And the whole time, instead of watching the game, I have binoculars trained on Sarah and Joe Brooks.
Of course, this was Scott's first love, so it was that kind of doubly terrible getting dumped, kind that takes extra long to get over. But after begging for her back, Scott started trying to move on, tried to avoid places she might be, tried to forget her. Of course, this is never an easy task, but for Scott, it turned out it was going to be even harder. Because right then is when this pesky song came out on the radio.
So many dreams I kept deep inside me.
It happened to be written by Joe Brooks. I learned that it was inspired by his rendezvous meetings with Sarah. You Light Up My Life.
You Light Up My Life. You probably know it. And it was about the woman of his dreams lighting up the life of the very rich and famous man Scott was dumped for.
And I triple, quadruply resented Sarah. Okay, she can have a fling with somebody. She doesn't have to have a fling who writes a song about her, written by Joe Brooks, about Sarah, played on the radio 230 times a day.
Everywhere Scott went, the song was playing. He woke up in the morning, the clock radio played it. Walking down the street, the cars that passed played it. He walked into the corner store for his morning cup of coffee. Sarah's song was playing there, too.
Even your friends get tired of your suffering, so you have to sort of suffer in silence. And I couldn't suffer in silence because I had to keep hearing the song. And it was like just a dagger in my heart every time I heard it. You know, and it's a bad song. It's a stupid, bad song that made $1 zillion. In no way, shape, or form did You Light Up My Life light up my life.
You
Thank you very much, Joe Brooks.
You Light Up My Life broke a record for the most weeks at the top of the charts. It haunted him for months. But during that time, there was no sign of Sarah herself, until one day, that critical rite of passage in any breakup arrived. The random run-in. The first chance to act like you're over it when you're not.
I'm taking the subway up to West 57th Street. Sarah walks into the train, onto the subway, and sits down next to me, and you know, it was awkward, but, you know, we exchanged pleasantries.
He comes out of the subway a little shaken, but feeling like, hey, maybe that was okay. Maybe, you know, I can really move on. And then, as he's walking by a music store, well, we'll spare you, but you guessed it.
It's hard enough to break up with somebody in general, but to hear this song continuously, and for whatever reason it would be referenced or... You know, I would hear it in the 80s, I would hear it in the 90s. I just heard this song and it was always a bummer. But now you've come along and you light up my life. You give me
hope to carry on. Sarah and Joe Brooks eventually broke up. And years later, let's just say the end of Joe's life wasn't as successful as the beginning. And for Scott...
You know, time heals all wounds, and time went by, and I got involved with another woman and sort of got my life together, and I got over Sarah.
Years later, late at night, Scott still occasionally would try digging around on the internet to try and remind himself of this woman he once loved and that once loved him. But there's no digital trace of Sarah. You Light Up My Life, on the other hand, still comes on the radio every now and again, always here to remind him of how badly he got burned.
So many relationships, good relationships, embrace the song and have such good feelings about You Light Up My Life, and all it does is bring misery to me.
I mean, that's what's so funny about this situation, right? Like, all relationships have, like, songs, smells, foods, things that are forever attached to that person and to that relationship. But this is like that on steroids.
Yeah, it's embedded in my memory. See, it would be a trip if Sarah actually, when this story is on the air, if she actually hears it. That would be a trip. That would be a real coda to the whole thing.
Scott Sanders, we feel your pain. And if anyone wants to donate their Tay-Tel record collection, do not send it to Scott Sanders. No. Send it to me, because Sarah's coming over tomorrow night for chicken. Scott, he's an actor, a writer. You can hear him at live storytelling events like Porchlight, The Moth, and Fireside. Learn all about Scott Sanders at snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Julia DeWitt and Mark Ristich, with sound design by Davey Kim. It's that time. You've hoped against hope, but I'm afraid it is almost here. Not to fear, because waiting for you right now, we've got full episodes, movies, pictures, stuff. It's all there. SnapJudgment.org. Facebook, Snap Judgment. Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and the tricksiest tricksters in Tricktown. Please say hello to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Masidi Miller rhymes with "Someone Stole My Dinner." Nancy Lopez can make a fire without matches. Julia DeWitt taught Nancy how to make a fire without matches. Joe Rosenberg is afraid of matches. Anna Sussman laughs at danger. Renzo Goria believes dance hall will save the planet. Leon Morimoto thinks that the planet will save dance hall. David Kim has never inhaled. Jasmine Aguilera dances in the rain, and Will Urbina has already put a stop to any nonsense. Now, what do Rambo, Die Hard, Men in Black, and Avatar have in common? Well, I'll tell you, it's not the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, will give you two
brand new, crisp dollar bills in exchange for a wrinkly old 20 out of the kindness of their hearts, PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago is the place at WBEZ. And now you know, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could trade a wine glass for a bottle of wine. A bottle of wine for a puppy for a bicycle for a stamp collection, the stamp for an iPhone, the iPhone for a sofa bed, the sofa for a freezer full of venison, the freezer for a VW bus, the bus for a floral shop, the shop for a condo, the condo for 40 acres and a mule. And you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.